This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As she studied history, Jennifer Michael Hecht noticed a pattern. She wasn't looking for it. She certainly didn't expect it. But out of the corner of her eye, she glimpsed an untold story of an overlooked factor. Many of the great scientists, religious leaders, doctors, ethicists, and poets had at least one thing in common, she decided: doubt. From Socratic dialogue to the skeptics, from Job to Jesus, the Buddha and the Zen masters, she traces the thread of doubt through the history of religion and belief to uncover a force that changed science, philosophy, morality, and worship. Later in this program, an update from Alabama on today's decision in the Ten Commandments case, and the great Oscar Robertson joins us to talk about basketball racism and his new autobiography, The Big O. But first, the history of the Big D, doubt. What role has doubt played in your religious life? Did questions about God and religion strengthen your faith or not? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And we have an email challenge this hour. Write and nominate somebody you think ought to be in the Doubters Hall of Fame and give us a brief comment on why. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from our bureau in New York is the author of Doubt, A History, Jennifer Michael Hecht. And good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me.
You describe the book as a study of religious doubt, and just as there are an awful lot of religions, there seems to be an awful lot of different kinds of doubt, too.
That's right. Of course, one could find doubt in all sorts of different ways, but I really wanted to concentrate on this idea that religious doubters seemed to be of a piece. They seem to have the same kind of daring and outrageous lives because they did question the religion that they were raised in, and having done so, they dared question other aspects of politics and science and the world around them.
Is doubt an attitude of mind? Is it a finite quality, or as you suggest in this history, does it have a narrative of its own, building on the on previous doubters?
I was amazed to find the extent at which it had a narrative of its own. I knew that these important figures had been remembered as doubters throughout history, but I didn't realize how much each century quoted and cited the doubters that came before. Hmm. In some cases, they're in such ways that they might be invisible if you didn't know to think of it, such as the books of Job and Ecclesiastes in the Bible. These are two doubters' texts. They're also believers' texts. They're beautiful stories for religion, but at the heart of them, they have deep doubt. Job specifically doubt in the idea of divine justice, and Ecclesiastes, where Job is more of a howl, Ecclesiastes more of a wink and a shrug, you know, kind of notion of hey, look, don't pray. We don't know if it works. And the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. The world isn't just. Nobody's watching. You should just find some good work to do and love your spouse. That's a very secular message. These two books have been cited by doubters every century, discussed as inspiring doubt, and once you know that, you see it everywhere. Mm-hmm. But it disappears if you don't know.
Where does doubt come from, do you think?
Well, I think it's there from the beginning. Of course, the question is where can you begin to find evidence? And in that sense, it's really people asking very straightforward kinds of questions. The earliest doubt that I found was 600 BC, the Carvaka in the East. The one of the earliest religions on the planet is Hinduism, and the Carvaka managed to doubt almost every aspect of Hinduism. They doubted karma, they doubted the gods, they doubted any idea of an afterlife. They laughed that if you thought you could burn the corpses of your parents so that they'd go up to heaven faster, well, why don't you give them an express trip and burn them before they die? It's because you don't really believe it. You know, they teased the priest, they teased the whole idea of religion and said instead we should try to have a good time in this world and be moral because it suits us. In the Western Hemisphere, the earliest Greek philosophers start to say, you know, maybe the gods of Olympus as described don't make a lot of sense. How else can we explain the universe? And it's in that way that they sort of really early on, Democritus comes up with atomism to say, nature seems sufficient to make itself. How could that work? Well, maybe if everything is made of one smallest thing falling into patterns.
And in that way, in that line of inquiry, you suggest that these great doubters have been the source of a great deal of innovation.
That's right, because every time you ask a question, you got to come up with an answer. And I mean that not only in science and politics. And the science part of it may seem more obvious. You question the doctrines that came before. You question all the places where often it's religion that sort of bandages over the parts that we don't know. And it's sometimes a doubter who has to ask, okay, if Zeus isn't making the thunderbursts, let's try to think about what kind of natural ways we could account for them. But also in religion, doubt is, you know, everybody, all religious people know that religion is historical, that it changes throughout time. Any Christian knows that they're not practicing the exact same Christianity that was practiced, say, in the Middle Ages. But how does that story evolve? How does it happen? And the answer is many, many times, it's not that some new idea builds on some other idea without some moment of doubt in between. Doubt's almost always there. Someone asking questions, someone saying, I don't believe this anymore. Someone saying, none of us like to do this ritual anymore. We don't see the point of it anymore. But mostly people just saying, it doesn't make sense to me. I don't believe it. And then people come up with an answer for it. And that's how religion evolves and changes.
And religion evolves and changes. You're arguing strongly that doubt does not always necessarily lead to agnosticism or atheism.
That's right. As a matter of fact, I find those terms almost impossible to use throughout all of history. They make sense for the present moment, but people describe the universe in such ways that at some point in history you might call the person an atheist, and in another point you call them a believer because of the ways that they deal with these questions. But certainly, the book is not about... it's not only about doubt that tends towards rationalism or secularism. It's also about doubt that, well, say Zen doubt, where doubt is the purpose of the religion. It's to cultivate doubt, not to get someplace else, but because the idea is that a fully integrated state of doubt is the most fulfilling and the most right place to be as a human being. And that's why the Zen koans make sense.
Some mind-bending concepts in this book, like a self-contained universe of doubt. I mean, that's that's very funny. Let's get some listeners involved. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org, and we're running an email challenge to nominate someone you think might be elected to the Doubt Hall of Fame and give us a brief reason why. Let's begin with Dennis, and Dennis is with us from Columbia, South Carolina.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's my story, and I'll try to keep it brief, is that I was raised a devout Catholic lifelong throughout my life, and I was actually taught, as you are in many religions, don't doubt this. This is just a matter of faith and all that. Then September 11th, 2001 came along, and from that date forward, I no longer considered myself a believer because I realized that those people that committed that heinous act actually believed in their heart that just because of a belief system, without any doubt, that they were going to reach eternity. The 70 virgin story, we have all heard that one. Whatever it was they believed it fervently enough to die for it. And then I thought how whacked out all of the religious thought in the world is. And I actually got into an analysis state of, you know, where religion came from. I actually read a book called The History of Religion, 4,000 years of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, and it proved to me that most of it was just a creation of man. We needed an explanation for things throughout the centuries, and God and religion have given us some of those answers, but we've found answers other ways now.
Jennifer Hecht?
Well, it's such an interesting story. I love it. The book is full of conversion stories to doubt because I love these moments where people start asking themselves new kinds of questions. You know, a great disaster is not always, it doesn't always lead to doubt or disbelief. Of course, there are religious answers, but it's also remarkable the extent to which when it's when a disaster is perpetrated by religious figures, that's when you start to see, or believers, that's when you start to see people really stopping and saying, is religion actually adding bad things to the world? And I want to preface this or add that the history of doubt was, I was surprised to find the extent to which it was not always a hostile relationship between religion and science, where for instance, doubters were trying to convince believers not to believe. That's really it comes out of the experience of the religious wars and the Inquisition, and that's why the Enlightenment figures are so angry at religion, because they had been perpetrating these monstrosities. There had been this bloody horror that they were reacting against, and that has led into the modern period. I also want to say that the idea of how we feel about doubt has changed a lot in America in the last 100 years, from an early period of the 20th century where it was actually kind of encouraged as nonconformism could be a healthy thing. Thomas Edison tells the New York Times early in the century that he doesn't believe in any kind of afterlife, any kind of personal God, and that's okay. By the middle of the century, communism and atheism have so been equated that atheism starts to look like treason. But now we find ourselves, after September 11 in the 21st century, in a very different place, where we recognize that the culture we love so much in the American way of life also has to be seen as you know, the most murderous tensions that we're dealing with now are not a place that's legislating atheism, but a place that's doubting way less than we are.
Dennis, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
A nominee for the Doubters Hall of Fame from Jeff Miller in Denver. Voltaire, he broke the back of Catholic power in France and therefore in Europe. So there's our first nominee. If you'd like to nominate somebody, TOTN at npr.org. Jennifer Hecht, certainly 9/11 was one event. There have been others in history that have triggered, you know, being at you know, propitious moments of time. You think of the earthquake in Lisbon that caused a lot of people to question, you know, how could a fair God do this? And of course, in more modern times, the Holocaust.
Yeah, absolutely. Though in all these cases, we do find people who doubt and find their way back to faith. The Holocaust is one of these really interesting ones where we know that there's a huge tradition of a kind of negative theology that comes out of that, where God is blamed and held accountable, but still being argued with. And so that's part of the story as well. But certainly it's these, you know, as much as an earthquake may shake people's faith, because it does seem like that, you know, where is the feelings in the rest of the universe? Why is humanity seem to be the only one that's moral in these cases? But it gets worse when it's something like slavery, for instance, where the church is backing it, where the church seems to be upholding the ideas of the oppressor. And that's when, you know, in the 19th century, there were huge numbers of doubters and atheists who went around and gave speeches, men and women, many, many women, arguing against slavery, for women's rights, and against religion.
Yeah, evangelical atheists, you call them.
That's right.
Yeah. We're speaking with Jennifer Michael Hecht. Her new book is called Doubt, A History. When we come back from a short break, we're going to take more of your calls at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And also, Jennifer Hecht has designed a short quiz to determine how much of a doubter you are. You can take a look at it at our website online at www.npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and we're talking today with historian Jennifer Michael Hecht about religious doubt, its history, and its role in propelling intellectual exploration. Her new book is Doubt, A History, and we want to hear from you. If you've questioned your faith, have your doubts strengthened your beliefs? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, TOTN at NPR.org. We have an email challenge going. Who should be placed in the Doubters Hall of Fame? Again, TOTN at NPR.org. Ian Gitter at the University of Minnesota writes, I would like to nominate René Descartes and his theory of mind-body dualism, suggesting the separation between the body and the mind and leading to the psychological science of behaviorism, that what we think is due to experiences and not a spirit of mind. And another one from Dr. Christopher Grasso. Carl Sagan, after being asked about faith, quote, I'd rather know than believe. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Sarah, who's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I'm really glad that this is being addressed in the book. I will read the book. I'm a big fan of doubters. I was raised Catholic, and after a friend asked me some questions, it was pretty simple, actually. I realized it was okay to question the religion, and so I became a rabid atheist and eventually became more of an agnostic. But I really had a question more than anything, which is, why do you think people react so intensely and sometimes violently when their beliefs are questioned?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that that there are different moments in history that encourage different kinds of responses. So that when you find a group that's basically homogenous, you know, it doesn't really exist. But when there's an isolated group where the people all see each other as basically the same, you actually can have an awful lot of questioning without people getting too upset about it. It just looks like they're trying to get the truth right and doesn't look like they're trying to overthrow anything.
They're trying to perfect it.
That's right, and they don't really even necessarily separate the idea that there's science and then there's religion and do they mesh. They're just trying to get both of those things right without separating them. And usually there's a lot of tolerance for it. What happens is that in more cosmopolitan periods, where, for whatever reason, people are all thrown together and your neighbors celebrate their supposedly universal God on a different day than yours, and they've been told not to eat these foods and you not to do these things, you start to notice it. And so cosmopolitan periods tend to have a tremendous amount of doubt, and the values that come along with cosmopolitanism are friendship and loyalty and questioning and science and change and all these things make it so that doubt can also very much be celebrated there. But that's where you see the birth of more fundamentalism or orthodoxies. Those types of ideas have to be built up against a background of people who are wandering away from religion. And it's once you have those kinds of tensions, then people start policing the boundaries of belief and really making that the issue. And that's when things get really scary. And I think that where we are right now is a kind of wonderful moment for doubt. It's a wonderful cosmopolitan period where there's a lot of exchange. The problem is there seems to be such partisanship, where believers are really only talking about these issues with believers and doubters only with doubters, and it breaks down to even the smallest kind of categories there, when I really don't think that the ideas, that's really what the quiz is about. It's not so much to place each person in a title of doubt, but to pull apart some of these ideas a little bit so that we can talk across, so that the conversation can open up a little bit.
And again, if you want to take a look at that quiz, it's on our website at npr.org. Sarah, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And let's go now to Angela, and Angela's with us in Corvallis, Oregon.
Hello, nice to have him on the show. I've got a question. I guess in regarding American society, we seem to be, I guess, you know, the quote, the religion of the masses. Our opiate today seems to be consumer fulfillment, really. Mm-hmm. And I guess in this sort of blind drive to satisfy ourselves in this easy secular means, I see faith falling by the wayside, and something of our acceptance of things, our lack of doubt seems to be growing. For example, you know, if an administration tells us this thing, even though our senses might say, well, this, our senses accept it, I see doubt really kind of lessening in this greater societal stance. Do you agree with this? And if so, how do we get back to reinvigorating this dynamic doubt in our society?
Excellent question. I think that I really think the doubters are out there, and that this is a nation of people who do question a great deal, who do argue about these ideas and think about them and take them apart, who are willing to think in secular terms and who are also willing to consider the good things about religion within the context of questioning. The problem really is that there isn't that it feels like it's illicit, like it feels that doubt is a despairing position. And that's one of the things I'm hoping to do with this book, to give doubt its history and its tradition, and therefore make it something that is reasonable to be proud about. And so that just as someone can say, you know, I'm taking on this policy out of a sense of faith, someone else could say, well, that my position is to keep an open mind, and that the history of doubt shows a great many people who have lived very well under those circumstances.
Yet Angela's point is, as we see the extent of religious belief arising in this country, at the same time it's draining away in Europe. Do you have any explanation for that in terms of doubt?
I'm not really sure that it is rising here. I think that it has a louder voice. And that's, I think, we would have to first check that there really isn't, because there certainly is a decline in church attendance, and there is a decline, there's a rise of secularism. The idea that secularism is then, instead of embracing the ideas of religion, embracing consumerism, that can be a real mistake and really misguided. There, the doubters throughout history have suggested the philosophies, meditations, mm-hmm. rituals, community that a doubter can have in replacement. And instead, you do get bread and circuses in places like the Roman Empire and the present moment. But I'm not sure that this is a country that is becoming more interested in blind faith. I think there just isn't a way of galvanizing the forces, because, after all, if you're a doubter, you're open to a lot of different ideas, and your attack is going to be much less pointed, unless, of course, there is at least the banner of doubt to stand behind. And that's what I think about it.
I think it does get down to education. If the education gives the doubters the self-confidence and the validation.
That's right.
And
exactly.
That's where we need to focus
Let me just add on. Do you see a correlation between doubt and the kind of human prosperity, a relative success of society, what some might, on the other hand, describe as human hubris, but go ahead.
Well, I think that sometimes when you have a place where everybody believes the same thing, that can be a very nurturing world. If you go back to the Greek polis or an early American town, but it tends to be best suited for just the ideal citizens, and there are many other people who aren't brought into it. These religious kind of certainties tend to have hierarchies. The periods of time which are often thought of as decline, the cosmopolitan periods of change and disruption, those are the times that we do see the most, the greatest advances in science and in political ethics and these ideas that we have to come up with some new way of making sense of the world, because we can't leave it up to a god, for instance. We've got to do the right thing ourselves.
Angela, thanks very much. Good call. And here's some more nominees from the Hall of Fame. Martin Luther suggests Tabitha Jensen. From his doubt resulted the 95 Theses, which questioned the extent of the Catholic Church's power and spawned the Reformation. And this from Chris Kuehl. I wanted to ensure that one of America's great doubters got some credit. James Madison was perhaps the most doubtful and pessimistic of the Founding Fathers. He was quite convinced that good government was nearly impossible, and strove to create a system that limited damage as opposed to creating some kind of political nirvana. And let's get another caller on the line. Charles from Denver, Colorado.
Hi, how are you doing? Thank you for taking my call. And
sure.
I listen to your show every day, and I really enjoy it, especially I'm enjoying today. I was raised Catholic and grew up Catholic almost all my life until I was about 35 or so, and then I began to see how that autocratic teaching was not exactly for me, and I began to embrace a broader spirituality at that time. And I think one of the things that really helped me was the whole idea of doubt and being able to question and being a skeptic about a lot of things. The church itself, I believe, helped me with some of the documents that came out of Vatican II, and I admire very much Pope John the 23rd, who helped to initiate a lot of new thinking, and I believe helped us to think it was all right to begin to question a lot of things in the church. I would recommend for one of your what did you call it?
The Doubters Hall of Fame.
Doubters Hall of Fame. A quote from Santayana, which is, "Skepticism is the chastity of the intellect, and it is shameful to surrender it too soon or to the first comer."
Very nice.
Nice quote, Charles. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Would John the 23rd be listed? Would he be included in your study of doubters? Would you include him?
You know, he's not in the book. I think that there were certain kinds of doubters that were clearly they could be understood as doubters, but they seemed more about the story of religion and not about people who are questioning it a little bit from the outside. Luther is in the book, but I think people will be a little surprised by what way, because the Catholic Church had really taken a tremendous amount of skepticism into its own philosophy by the time Luther came around. One of Luther's great quotes that's in the book is the Holy Ghost is not a skeptic, because Catholicism had really at that moment been into skeptical fideism, which was the idea that we can't know anything at all about religion or about God, so we should just abandon ourselves to a blind faith. And Luther really comes along and says, forget this skepticism. We simply believe. We believe everything in the Bible. That's the challenge. And so he's that kind of doubter.
Why have we not had a history of doubt until now?
Well, wonderfully, we've had histories of doubt in almost every century. I was shocked to see how often people put together compendiums of the great doubters right through history. But the 20th century, for specific reasons that had to do with the way history was being done, but also because of this sort of tension between history and religion, there's just been a kind of denial that it exists at all. And that's one of the reasons that the book has some weight to it, because I had to show how many there were, how many obvious doubters, Islamic doubters in the Middle Ages, doubters, you know, throughout. The first chapter is called "Whatever Happened to Zeus and Hera?" You know, where we all know everyone believed, and then we all know at some point everyone didn't. But how did that story happen? Clearly, doubt is not just a modern phenomena, and there was just a kind of cultural taboo against really looking at it. And I'm certainly not the only one who's been questioning that, but most of the others are experts in more narrow fields, and their work is all cited in the book. But nobody had yet come along and said, let's take a good, strong look at this and see it. And to me, it just, once you draw circles around the shadows on the history of belief, you realize they're not shadows on the history of belief. They're their own story. They keep referring to the same martyrs, the same heroes, the same prophets almost. And they have their own great version of the human experiment.
Jennifer Michael Hecht, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Jennifer Michael Hecht is a history professor at Nassau Community College. Her new book is called Doubt, A History. She joined us from our bureau in New York, and two final nominees for the Doubters Hall of Fame from Matt and Heidi in Portland, Oregon. For the greatest doubter, my wife and I suggest Charles Schulz's cartoon character Linus, who doubted the existence of the Great Pumpkin while sitting in the pumpkin patch on Halloween. He was shocked when he caught himself saying, if, when describing the ensuing appearance of the greatest of gourds to the rest of the Peanuts gang. And this from Kevin Lee in San Francisco. Nominee, whomever is managing the Yankees, this person doubts he'll be the manager next year, no matter how many games won. No, say it ain't so, Joe. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.